Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the April 18th edition of Zero Point show on BBS. I was realizing today the show now has been going on almost 3 years, or close to 3 years, and so I'll soon be beginning the fourth year of shows, and I do urge people to listen to some of the shows of Zero Point through the archives, as there's a lot of good material on all aspects of mystical studies and consciousness studies and science of the soul and contemporary issues and so on. My co-host, James Moffat, isn't able to be with us today, so I'm going to take a half hour at the beginning of the show just to share some thoughts and do some teaching, and then on the half hour I'll be having a guest, Ben Stewart, who's a producer with his brother Dan Stewart of the movie Chymatica, a very interesting movie which we'll come to later, and I think he also may have been involved in producing The Esoteric Agenda, another similar type of documentary movie. So he'll be our guest today for at least an hour, and I'll close up the show after that. My background, I always begin a little bit at the beginning for people who may be new listeners. I'd like to introduce myself. My background, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist. I received my PhD over 30 years ago. I was a university professor of psychology for 12 years, and then I worked in the prison system for 12 years. And then over the last 5 years or so, I've worked under, just independently, under the Zero Point logo. And Zero Point is described as an institute for mystical and spiritual science. And my lifelong interest has been in the psychology of human consciousness, and then that led into the study of the science of the soul, and I'm widely studied in occult teachings, at least certain aspects of them. My earliest influences were in the Gurdjieff Uspensky Fourth Way teaching, and in that, for 10 years, I studied almost exclusively or primarily the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching. And it's a remarkable system of psychology which provides a very practical way of understanding yourself and what the parts of our being is, and how do we try to understand what consciousness is. And at the time, I was a graduate student in psychology, and I realized that Gurdjieff's ideas about psychology were far in advance of anything that was there in academic psychology. I was in my PhD studies at the time. And here are a few of the ideas that were most important from Gurdjieff. First idea of esotericism is that people in life are not properly conscious. They are not properly awake. But instead, people are conditioned like automatons or robots, and we're conditioned by our past, and we're conditioned by our environment. And over time, a child loses their essential consciousness and acquires this false consciousness system of all the rubbish they've learned through watching the TV and the media and the educational system and all the things you're taught in school. So much of common thought and teaching and education and so-called knowledge is, from a Gurdjieff perspective, simply rubbish. That it's all wrong understanding, misconceptions throughout all of the mainstream of psychology. And as I studied the Gurdjieff teaching, I could see this more and more, how everything I'd been teaching, although everything was valuable in its own way, at the same time, there was no understanding of the larger whole. and it led only to confusion and lack of understanding. So some of the ideas from Gurdjieff, firstly, that we're not properly conscious. We have to wake up. And Gurdjieff says the next level of awakening of human consciousness in people is to attain what he calls the state of self-consciousness. Now, he explains that the problem is that people think they already have this self-consciousness. And when I was a university professor, I had a group of students, and we did an experiment. We had questionnaires we gave people, asking people, how well do you think you know yourself? And 80 to 90% of people think they know themselves very well, or pretty well or very well, were the levels on the scale. And the vast majority of people think that they know themselves. But from a Gurdjieff perspective, what people think they know of themselves really is all part simply of the false consciousness system. It's not knowing of themselves in the deeper esoteric or spiritual way. Gurdjieff explains an important distinction between what he calls essence and personality in a person. And he says this distinction isn't in modern psychology, and I would agree with that, that it still is not in modern psychology. The essence, he says, is what we are in our being, in the makeup and constitution of what we are as organisms and physical systems, and in the makeup of what he calls the centers in the human being. Because he says a human being, in a way, we don't simply have one mind, but really we have both a threefold nature and a sevenfold nature. So the threefold nature, Gurdjieff explains that we function mentally, emotionally, and physically. So we're called, in his book, Beelzebub's Tales, grandson, he always refers to the three-brained beings on planet Earth. They function mentally, which is centered in the mind, in the head, emotionally, which is related to the heart and the autonomic nervous system, and is centered in your chest, and then your physical nature, which Gurdjieff says the brain for that is the spinal column, and its extension into the upper part of the brain cord in the brain in the head. So that's the brain. Gurdjieff says that each of these aspects of ourselves has its own brain or its own mind. Gurdjieff says that most people have the wrong idea. They think there's one mind in the human being. Whereas he's saying, well, really, there are these three separate minds. You have the mind in your head, and then you have a whole other mind in related to your heart and your autonomic nervous system, which is the centers for emotions and feelings. And then you have the mind in your spinal column. And that includes the sensory motor nerves that go out through the body so that you can be aware of your physical sensation and physical experience. So we function mentally, emotionally, and physically. Now, in contrast, psychology at the time and even today is defined as the science of behavior and the mind. And it's regarded dualistically, as though there's simply a mind in the head and a body. So we have the mind and the body, and all philosophers had philosophical debates endlessly about the mind-body dualities, or the difference between the psyche and the soma. And they think in a dual manner about human beings. But psychology is the science of behavior and the mind. So it's a physical aspect, and the mind is the mental. But there in modern psychology is no psychology of the heart or of the soul. because psychologists think that the mind is all up in the head, where the brain is and where they think the self is, all up in the head. That's what they're taught. This is called the head doctrine, which is the main teaching you get today in psychology and philosophy and everywhere, is the people belief in that the mind is in the head, and that's what the what produces consciousness. So I call that the head doctrine. But from Gurdjieff's perspective, that whole system of consciousness that's centered in the mind, or what he calls the formatory apparatus, he says that's the basis of your personality or your false personality. But your essence is related to your heart center and your higher, what he calls your higher emotional center. Now, so the idea is our essential consciousness is heart consciousness. And when we're born, a child exists in this, that state. A child, a baby in a sense, is what it is. It is itself. It hasn't yet been conditioned and influenced by the environment. But as that child grows up, he'll acquire all different personalities and fears and understanding of himself, all of which is acquired from outside of himself. That's not intrinsic to who he is in his being, but is acquired from outside. See, that's why it's the personality is something that's taken over from outside of yourself, and then it becomes yourself. Or you, what you think is yourself. So most people think they know themselves, and they think they know what they know in a way is their personalities and their false ego. Now, the idea in mystical science is epitomized by a fellow, Ramana Maharshi, who defines yoga as involving the disillusion of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. And so there the idea is that the consciousness in most people is centered in the mind and the head, but it involves a disillusion of that false consciousness system and then the experience of the self connected to the lotus of the heart. Because the heart is, in mystical teachings, is compared to a flower. It's a lotus, the heart lotus in India. In the Christianity, it is the rose of the heart. That's why they have the Rosicrucians, which is the rose of the heart. In the image of a cross, and you have a rose where the two arms intersect. That's the heart, the rose of the heart. Or you can see pictures of the Sacred Heart of Christ, and these that shows the illuminated heart of Christ. So in mystics say, know thyself. That's one statement made. And then another variation on that says, know thyself and thou shalt know the universe and the gods. Okay, now, most people think they know themselves, but they don't really think they know the universe and the gods. Okay, now, the basis of that statement, though, is to know thyself is to realize this underlying consciousness of the essence, in the heart. See, that is the self we have to attain to the experience and awakening of that consciousness of the heart. So it's not knowing your personality and your ego, false ego, based in your head, in your mind, which is all the information and conditioning you've taken in from things around you, but instead it's this inner experience of the self within the heart. And in all different mystical traditions, and this is what ties together Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, the secret doctrine of Blavatsky, the Gurdjieff teaching, all these mystical teachings suggest that a human being's essential self is connected to the heart. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all living beings. Okay. In the Kabbalistic teaching of the tree of life, if you're familiar with the symbol, the glyph with 10 spheres that are arranged on 3 pillars, and that represents the tree of life. And in that, the higher 3 sephira of the tree of life, those 3 come down the central pillar and they anchor into the sphere of Tiphereth, which in Kabbalah is associated with the sun and with the human heart. So the idea in Kabbalistic tree is the higher forces come down and anchor into the heart center. But in Kabbalah, under the heart center, the next lower center, below that, is said to be the level of the mind, or also of the moon. And that is your lower self. Okay, it is said to be centered over the genitals, because in a way in life, people are controlled by their genitals. This is such a powerful motivation in people's lives. So the sun is in Tiphereth, and then the moon, the level of the lower psyche is connected to the mind and connected to the moon, or the yesod. So in Kabbalistic teachings, what we want to do is ascend the central column of the tree of life. The tree of life is a picture, a model of higher dimensional space. So we want to ascend from Yesod to Tiphereth, and that would be self-realization, to awaken in Tiphereth, in this consciousness of the heart connected to the sun. Because the self in the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating like the sun. Okay, so it's like the sun. The jiva atma is self-illuminating like the sun. It is the sun of the body, of the physical body. And if you look at a human being, like from a scientific perspective, it's actually the case that the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of the mind and brain in the head. So if you take a human being as a living quantum system, well, the center of that system would be the heart. And in science, it's a complete enigma how the heart generates the electromagnetic beat that starts the SA node and generates through the heart in 3 phases. And this beat is, scientists have been unable to explain the generation of the heartbeat within the heart. It's one of the mysteries of science, how this is done. Because there's no external causes which cause the cells of the heart to have this intrinsic functioning of function of generating the heartbeat. Well, in the mystical point of view, what that's because in a way we have a zero point center connected to the heart, that there is some quanta or jiva atma in higher dimensional space, and it's the energies or influences or light of that jiva atma which somehow emerges through the dimensions of the heart and brings life into the human being through the mechanisms of the heart. And then in mystical teachings, consciousness circulates from the heart. It's connected to the blood flow in the body. So you can experience consciousness all through your body, connected to your blood flow. Now, this is a very different idea than the modern science, where the scientists believe that the neurological processes of the brain produce consciousness in the head. Okay? And I'm saying, no, that's completely wrong. Consciousness originates from this higher dimensional jiva atma, or God spark, or divine spark, or monad for Blavatsky. There's some God spark or element within each human being, and that's connected to the heart and the higher dimensional physics of the heart. See, the heart isn't simply what we think it is, a mass of soft muscle tissue. No, somehow there's a higher dimensions to the nature of what the heart is. In Kabbalist teachings, there are said, as elsewhere, there are said to be four world orders associated with the elements of fire, air, water, and earth. Those four worlds, they're connected to the world, the divine world of emanations. So your jiva atma is a divine emanation. It is a God particle. It's a divine emanation. Your little individual I, your particle of God. Okay, that's a divine emanation. Second world is this spiritual world. Okay, and that's you, your divine element is then embodied into a spiritual self within the spiritual world. And then below the spiritual world, you have the psychical world. And you have a psychical nature, the mind and the astral body and astral influences, which are below the spiritual world. And then fourthly, you have the material world, symbolized by the element earth. So really, you exist within the divine world, the spiritual world, the psychical world, and the material world. And these worlds interpenetrate one another throughout space. They're not out there beyond us or above us. Like often people think your higher self is outside of you, up in above you in the sky somewhere or something, which may in some ways be true aspects, but it's wrongly understood. Our higher self, the self that we want to attain to knowledge of, is this self connected to the higher dimensional physics of our own hearts. So then I have to, what do I mean by higher dimensional? And that takes us into the study of physics and trying to understand dimensions. And even in the newest ideas of physics, they now have what they call 11-dimensional Kaluza-Klein supergravity theory or 11-dimensional string theory. And these new theories propose that the four large dimensions are all based upon a 7-dimensional hyperspace. So what things manifest in the world are all based on 7-dimensional hyperspace dimensions, which exists at every point. So these are the newer models. And this is a model consistent with what's taught in spiritual and esoteric teachings, all of which have this notion of the law of 7. That not only are, when creation occurs, not only are there 7 planes of existence and 7 chakras in the human being and 7 rows of elements in the periodic tables and 7 differentiations of the fundamental light, everything is sevenfold. And not only is the sevenfoldness inherent to creation, but it's also inherent within the hyperspace even before creation occurs. The 7 depths of the Divine Mother, the waters of space referred to in the book of Genesis, when the Spirit of God moves upon the face of the waters. Well, the waters are said to be 7 cubits deep, meaning that there are 7 levels within hyperspace. So when creation happens, according to the secret doctrine, it becomes 7 inside, 7 outside. So when 7 worlds are created, the reason there are 7 was that the sevenfoldness was inherent within hyperspace even before creation happened. And then creation only embodies the pattern of design inherent within hyperspace. Anyway, these are complex things to come to understand. I've been talking about the idea of consciousness and what is consciousness, and Gurdjieff's teaching, how we're not properly awake. We have to attain to the state of self-consciousness. And people in life don't ordinarily understand what their self is, because their essential consciousness passes into the unconscious. So your true consciousness is more in your unconsciousness. So we have to, in a way, get back to this and awaken and learn to live in the consciousness of the heart. The Jews have a beautiful saying or statement that the truth is under your nose the whole time. And if you think of that, oh yeah, just under my nose, oh, there's my heart, just under my nose. So the truth is just under your nose all the time. But you don't think it's under your nose. You look outside of yourself into the universe trying to find the truth about yourself. And you look into the stars and into the galaxy, or you look to see your reflection in things outside of yourself in your life. Whereas the whole time the truth is hidden within the higher dimensions of the human heart. So this is a mystery teaching that's in all the world's religions. And I mentioned a few, Christianity and Judaism. See, Christ is within the heart. You love God within the heart. The heart is connected to the soul. People know that intuitively, the heart and soul. And so as the heart turns, so becomes a man. If the heart is controlled by a human being's lower nature, then in a way you can lose your soul and be controlled by your lower nature. Or if you can turn about within the heart, then you can ascend and experience the higher centers or higher levels of human existence. In a way, if you look at the human chakra system, there are three chakras below the heart and three above. And where most people are conditioned into the three lower chakras, and the three lower chakras control the mind. And those three lower chakras are concerned with money, sex, and power. That's kind of what the world is all about. All the psychopathic deviants we have who kind of manage our world and whose greed, you know, they commit atrocities around the world and murder people to make money and to have power. You see, money, sex, and power. Those are the principal motives of the psychopathic elite who have taken over the planet. The scum that rose to the top of the waters of life. And the next level then in human evolution on the planet is the attainment to the consciousness of the heart and this essential human consciousness. We have to become what's in Christianity talked about as being upright of heart. And if you ever see the picture, I have a picture on my website of from Jacob Bohm of the mystical heart, the spiritual heart. And what it shows is the heart turned upside down from how we usually consider it. And it's shown as burning in flame. See, the spiritual heart is turned the other way relative to the material heart, which is turned downwards. So we have to find our way through to the spiritual heart, awaken the spiritual heart, which is like this higher dimensional aspect of our own heart, and learn to live in the consciousness of the heart. And as that happens, you can then, the light of the heart can then illuminate higher centers in the throat chakra, the brow chakra, or the crown chakra. And you can have other types of mystical and psychical experiences. Thus we have what Blavatsky calls the doctrine of the I, which is more commonly associated with the elites, which is a symbol with the pyramid with an I in its center. And that's a symbol of the elites. That's the one that they put on the dollar bill. Okay. Blavatsky also has that as a sacred symbol because that represents the awakened eye of dogma. So, which means the illuminated mystic or the seer attains to the awakening of this higher center. But Blavatsky also says, and here's a quote from The Voice of the Silence. She says, "Learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom. the eye from the heart doctrine. But even ignorance is better than head learning with no soul wisdom to illuminate and guide it. The doctrine of the eye is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect. Great Sifter is the name of the heart doctrine. This is what I did for 30 years, was I tried to sift through all the things I learned through psychology and philosophy and my own experiences, and what I came to is the heart doctrine. And that's what the Zero Point show is about, is trying to understand the mysteries of the heart and attaining the next level of human evolution, which involves the awakening of the heart. And if we could do this, and this is a teaching that that unifies Christians, Muslims, Native Americans have the same heart doctrine teaching. See, the problem in the world isn't conflicts between religions. That's what people have been led to believe. That's what the elites have fostered to try to undermine spirituality and religion in our societies. True religions all have the same esoteric teachings of the heart, and that's what we need on this planet, is we need Muslims and Jews who are upright of heart, and Christians, and atheists, or whatever you might be, but those upright of heart, we need to come together to join forces to oppose the great forces of evil which have overtaken our culture and society and are threatening to plunge us into a third world war or mass exterminations of people and mass impoverishment of people and poisoning people through chemtrails. We were sprayed so heavily here in Ottawa the last 3 days, chemtrails. You know, dozens of planes all across the sky. And there they are, you know, they're the psychopathic elites, you know. There they are poisoning us and your children and your land. And they want you to get inoculations and poison you there, and they'll poison your food. These people, these psychopaths. See, that's what became, because they never attained to this level of the awakening of the heart. You see, they don't experience anything. They don't have compassion in their heart for other living beings. Like, I look at movies of, you know, all the Israelis, they mass murder people in Palestine. It breaks my heart to see that. It's like they're our children. They're my children. You know, but to that, those people are heartless. They lose their soul. You see, that's what happens. People lose their soul when they become heartless. And then that's what's happened. The world's been taken over by these people who have lost their souls and who are heartless. So that's why around the world, those of us who want to, like, be upright of heart and reclaim our sanity and wake up, and we need to come together and have courage to face this beast which is upon us and is threatening to annihilate our planet. They don't care. They'll hide away in their little holes in the ground or in their places in Paraguay or wherever. They've got plans for themselves. They've stored up food. They don't mind eliminating a few millions of people. These people, see, that's what these people are like. They're what I call the old world psychiatric disorder. They think they got a new world order to sell to you. Believe me, it's not a new world order. These people have been in control for centuries. It's the old world psychiatric disorder. That's what they're trying to do, is finalize their old world psychiatric disorder. And human beings on this way, we never had a chance at evolution. They fed us so much false knowledge through education and the media to keep us dummy down. So we never attained to knowledge of the heart and soul. And that's what became, because they lack that themselves, you see. All Henry Kissinger, his aphrodisiac is power. He likes to have power over other people. Like, my God, why would anyone, who cares? Who wants power over other people? Personally, I have no desire or need for power over other people. Now, I want to be free in myself. I want other people to be free in themselves. So this is part of the psychopathology of the world elites, from my perspective. And and then some of the mysteries of the human heart and mysteries of human consciousness. Okay, so I've talked on for 35 minutes. I'm going to just take a break for a minute, and then we'll be back with our guest. Okay, remember... Welcome. Back again. Okay, just a short break there, and I think we have our guest online. Today is film producer Benjamin Stewart, and he, with his brother Dan, has produced Kermetica, which is an informative and very nicely produced documentary movie looking at the issues of the psyche and the mind and what's happening on the planet and nature of the self and so on. So I'm very pleased to have you, Benjamin. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me on the show. I've been following your work for quite some time now, and it's truly an honor to be on the show with you.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm honored to have you on. I don't know, did you happen to hear the first my first talk through the first half of the show?
I actually wasn't able to listen into that.
Okay, just let me know where you are, because I was talking about the issues of the nature of self, and
okay.
It really, what I was sharing really ties into, you know, the what your movie's about, a bit of a different perspective, but I'll share that with you as we discuss your movie and your work. When did you finalize your movie, and maybe you can just share a little bit about it and how you, I'll give you the floor a little bit, Benjamin, just to describe your work.
Well, the film was finished and actually released on January 31st of this year, 2009, so it's only been out for a short while. Really, what drove me to create this film, along with my brother and my wife and some motivational factors around the house and around my local community, was really just noticing that I had been reading up on a lot of, like, global issues, whether political, religious, social, economic, what have you. And basically, for the past few years, I'd been reading up on this, and I've been noticing that a lot of action was being taken. A lot of people were trying to become involved in things, movements, different types of rebellions, revolutions, whatever you want to call it, people trying to get involved in certain things. But what I was noticing a bit of a lack in was a lot of self-understanding of why things come about. There's more of an esoteric way that things actually do formulate and principles that things work upon. And what I was noticing was that people were focusing more on the exoteric, more of the things that just the topical level of things that were going on, things that they would like to change in the world, things that they would like to see become better or brighter or more beautiful. And really, I just wanted to make a contribution to show my concern that we should be putting we should put as much emphasis as we can on the external world, but we also want to make sure that we are looking inwardly and looking at the self and really just exploring ourselves, because pretty much, I'm an Army brat. I've moved all around the world. I was moving once every year from year one. So really what I've come to notice in all this traveling was that I had one soul companion that I always had right by my side my entire life, and it took me until I was maybe 19, 20 years old before I truly realized that I myself was, you know, I was the one who really carried me through all these times. You know, I'd been right by my side all this time, but I didn't really know myself. I'd never taken the time to get to understand why I react to certain things in certain ways and how I create my own future and how I create my own present. And really when I started to come to a little bit better of an understanding of how I was actually creating the world around me, that's when I started to realize that I wanted to, in the best way that I can, bestow that upon other people without preaching, just basically sharing my experience, because the only thing that I ever claim to be an expert on is myself, and that's really what I try and do. So the film is really just a compilation of things that I have experienced, things that I have come across in research and resonated with me very strongly. And it took several years to compile all the research, but finally, by the beginning of this year, I finished it. And like I said, January 31st of 2009 was when I finally put it out there.
Yeah, well, it certainly raises the whole issue of, like, trying to understand ourselves and the nature of our own consciousness and mind, and how that relates simultaneously to everything we see about us in the world, like the insanity of the world. And that's very interesting. I think of the first alternative movie along this line was the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, or something like that.
Right, by William Martin. Yeah.
Which I thought, not too bleeping much, did they know, because I was very, very critical of that movie and really thought it was primarily rubbish, even though there were valuable elements in it. But
right.
you take it to a whole next level of complexity of trying to understand those issues of the mind and the psyche, but relating it to the whole world situation and human history and all the terrible things that are going on in the world. So it's very provocative, and it's such an important area of investigation. Like, people have to understand these issues more deeply in order to try to shift human consciousness enough that we can deal with this kind of rampant criminality that's prevalent on our planet. I mean, it's really quite tragic.
Absolutely. I mean, what I've actually noticed, I mean, one thing that I tried to have at least strike a balance with in this film was not to fearmonger too much, but also not to sugarcoat, not to pull any punches, because I wanted to make it very... at least I wanted to make it very apparent that there are things in this world that we choose not to look at. Just like as within ourselves, there are things we choose not to look at, and these are things that are very important. They bring about a bit of fear, and they're scary at times to look at, but it's necessary to look at these things and to understand them. It's necessary to process a lot of the darker content, a lot of the shadow content, the things that we come in contact with every day, but we just want to turn our head. You know, I mean, I have a lot of friends and family, even still to this day, that when I ever raise a point about some of the things that are going on at the highest levels of the economic structure or the governing apparatus, or even, you know, in the Vatican or in any of these fields, they just shut their minds off to it, because it's not that they don't believe it, they just don't typically want to know about it, because they feel comfortable in this little bubble that they've created. And they don't realize...
In the early part of the show, I was talking about that and saying how this whole, what Gurdjieff calls a false consciousness system, which is acquired through your conditioning and education and the media, and you acquire this whole false consciousness system, and people cling to that in fear. That's kind of like, people can't deal with the kinds of things you say. Like, you know, it's like I go out and I try to tell people, you know, look, these are chemtrails up in the sky. You're being poisoned, and I see how people react. Like the other day, like one older man, he couldn't even listen. He couldn't. I could just feel his fear. Another younger woman, she kind of like was attentive and like, you know, interested in what I had to say. She still had that openness about it. But it's very interesting, people's reactions. Like, people have been led to believe so many lies, you know, the lies of democracy, the lies of social justice, you know, the lies of the government, the lies of the war, the lies of 9/11, the lies of all the inoculations, all these lies people are getting all the time. And to wake up to that is pretty horrifying, really, to grasp it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think what it shows is more of a comfort factor. I mean, I mean, right here in the United States, you hear, you know, this strong talk, especially under the Bush administration, after 9/11, you heard this strong, like, rhetoric about freedom, American freedom, the land of the individual. But what it really is to me, upon, like, further investigation, is it's really doublespeak, because everything that they claim to be freedom, everything that they, every document that they put, you know, such as the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, all these things, everything that went into play that supposedly was there to protect our freedom was exactly the opposite of it. And it, I mean, no wonder it drives some people crazy, thinking, how can these people not see that such things as the Patriot Act is destroying freedom? It's destroying patriotism. It's destroying the exact same thing that it's saying that it's working towards. And the reason for that,
yes,
it is not because of anything truly, I mean, it, yes, it's deceptive, but it's not just that. It's the fact that people, in general, these people are too afraid. They feel fear towards true freedom, because when you start really boiling it down to realize what true freedom is, it means that you are responsible for your life. You are self-governing, and you don't have all these other different governing apparatuses, these other authority figures to be there that, you know, the animus archetype, the father, you know, the big daddy that you can run to if you have any trouble or problems or anything, you know, the insurance companies, the authority figures, the judges, the government, all these things. People don't realize that they deep down inside feel attached to, like they are bonded to them. They are the slave to this master, and they don't even realize it because they don't know what true freedom is to them, because they've never really studied it. They've never really investigated what freedom means to them on the inside.
No, and instead they've been conditioned, had their minds so conditioned with all this falsity of knowledge, like the falsity of 9/11. It had nothing to do with Muslims. You know, Americans kind of think you're going over to the Middle East to protect America. It's a complete fraud. It's just a big lie. You're over there, you know, to extend the world control of the elites and for drugs and oil and military bases. It's got nothing to do with the Muslims attacking America for your freedom. The whole thing was a fraud. And then you realize that that fraud is perpetuated through all the corporate media, who are all pathological liars. The whole thing is a complete fraud. You know, and then you learn the history. Oh, yeah, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, you know, he came over and they got into media and they took over Hollywood and they took over all the media, and they fabricate this completely false consciousness. And that's what people, and then people are so, you know, it's the lies are so huge that it does cause anxiety. You know, and Gurdjieff, Mystic Gurdjieff, talks about three stages of awakening, or it's real awakening of consciousness. And he says, well, the first, he says, is awakening. And that's kind of like waking up and beginning to realize what's really being done and all the lies. And then he says you experience death. And that death is like the dissolution of everything you thought you knew, where everything is lies, like everything you believed in, and it's all been lies. You see, and that, so people don't want to go through that death. And then he says the third aspect is, he says, being reborn, which, in, as I teach it, is getting back to the consciousness of the heart and the essence, living in your essence, which is what you described as freedom. Like there you have real freedom a bit. But people have become conditioned. I mean, that's what I thought was really valuable about your work, is exploring these issues of the nature of the psyche simultaneously with looking at what was happening on a global level and history and so on.
Right. And that's absolutely very profound what you said about the stage of going through the death before you can get to the essence, you know, what the true freedom would be. Because that's a process that many people, I would assume, many people don't truly understand, because a lot of people are attached to this thing called it's the pleasure principle, and it's the comfort factor. And really what people equate, anything that is unpleasurable and anything that causes discomfort or anxiety is wrong. It's bad. And with no investigation, it's simple to see how people can fall into that illusion. So people consistently, they don't want to go through the process, that dying process, in a sense, that very symbolic process that you need to go through to really see the world for what it truly is, and to even see your life for what it truly is. And what's interesting about that is that whole process, that whole catabolic process where you're breaking things down, it really makes things so much more simple. I mean, a lot of people that I hear feel that you need to read a tremendous amount of books to get to the point where some people are. They feel that you need to, sit in quiet meditation without really understanding what really, like, quiet meditation truly is there for. And a lot of people feel that they need to go through specific steps written out in a book, or maybe spoken by someone that they feel is an authority figure on the subject, when really what I try to show is that it is very possible that, yes, you can go through that catabolic phase, that death process, but what it really requires is really just taking a step back and not looking at the physical things around you, but just feeling how you interact with your environment. I mean, when I first started to go through that process, where I realized that, you know what, I'm not learning much more by just reading these things, I need to actually walk the walk. And I took several months from reading anything, from watching any videos, and really from immersing myself in that. And I just really, I mean, I also do landscaping on the side for pleasure. And just being out in nature and taking some time to actually just observe your local environment, your local community, observe yourself, how you interact with people. I mean, that's really one process that really allows us to understand ourselves in a way that most people, I would imagine most people don't really know themselves that well. And it's very difficult to get to a process where you can break down these illusions, the illusion of the false ego, this identity, this label that we put on ourselves, whether, you know, we believe that, you know, when someone says, who are you? And you say, well, I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, you know, I'm a mother, I'm a father. These things, they're all fine and good, but they don't really explain what the essence is about us. And when you don't know that, it's very difficult to discern what you are from what you are not when you don't even know what you are. So I really do like, I guess you said it was Gurdjieff that explained it. That was the second process?
Yeah, he distinguishes between what he calls your personality and your essence. Mm-hmm. And he says, your essence is what you are in your being, like in the structures of what you are as a being. But your personality is how you've been conditioned or influenced by things outside of yourself. So it's taking things into yourself as yourself, but which really originate from outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens when you're born. You're still in your essence, like a baby hasn't developed the mind and this false ego yet. Baby's still in their essence. I believe the blissfulness you see in the baby is because they still experience the bliss of the bliss sheath within the heart, that inner experience of self in the heart. But then as you grow older, the mind and consciousness become more and more centered in the head. And it forms a false consciousness system. So I was explaining before you came on about in mystical teachings, it is said self-realization is defined as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So the idea is the ego, I would say, is centered in your mind, in your head, whereas yourself is centered within your heart. And what the next level of human evolution is the awakening in the heart center. Now, you have aspects of that in your movie, but then at other points, I think you need to understand this hard doctrine teaching to understand what you're dealing with in your movie. You had some interesting quotations from the Heart Math Institute, where it kind of talks about the, you know, how the heart seems even more influential than the mind or the in the head. And one of the statistics from the Heart Math Institute is how the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of the mind in the head. So as a quantum system, our center is really the human heart. And I think that's where our essence is. That's as before you came on, I was also saying there's a Jewish expression that the truth is under your nose all the time. And I look under my nose and there's my heart.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the truth is under my nose being awakened in the heart. And when you talked about growing up, my sense was, see, as a psychologist, like I see sometimes people grow up and they remain still in their essence. Because as you grow up, you have loving parents who try to provide for you and you have favorable life circumstance and a loving home or opportunity. And then you retain that feeling of the heart through your life and you're centered in your essence more. Whereas if people grow up under more abusive condition, then what happens is you contract about the heart. It forms knots about the heart. And then more and more you lose yourself and you become controlled by the mind.
Right.
So in your movie, you don't formulate it quite as I do. There are elements of it in some of what you have drawn from the Heart Math Institute, and you show the heart at some points, and but at other times when you're raising the issue of what is consciousness. Like I know when you raise it early on, you show a picture of a brain in a head, and it's kind of illuminated like the blood flow. And you have the looking like raising what is consciousness, and you show a picture of the brain in the head. In my work, I critique that. I say everybody writes a book about consciousness. Everybody puts a head on the cover of the book. And I say, well, but when I write a book about consciousness, I show a picture of the heart. Because I think it originates out of the heart rather than being produced by the mind in the head.
Right, absolutely. And I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I believe that it is, and when I was getting into the work with Heart Math Institute, I definitely tried touching upon it there. And I even tried to bring up that, I mean, consciousness is something that, I mean, whether we would even go so far as to say where it truly originates, one thing that that I see a lot of people getting into is the fact that they have a difficult time even discerning between what is the intellect and what is consciousness in general. And
yeah.
I try to touch upon that quite a bit. And I mean, there's quite
that's
a few
very important what you're saying. Just to stay with that, because I think that's such an important point. It was like what you were saying earlier about, like, kind of through your life, you know, you read, and you can develop your mind. You could read a thousand books, and in fact, you'd probably be further from consciousness by the time you're done, rather than closer to it. You know, in a way to explore consciousness. This is what I learned from Gurdjieff 30 years ago. He says psychology has to begin with self-study. You have to study yourself. You have to get right back to sensing your own being existence, to know yourself, and not just developing the mind. And your movie show has that valuable element to it.
Right.
So
I
stopped you up a bit.
Oh, no, that's fine. I absolutely agree with that statement because one of my mentors, I mean, through at least literature, is Carl Jung. I mean, one of the greatest teachers, I believe, And one of the things that I admired most about his work, I mean, there's a lot that I still haven't really delved into with Jung, but one thing I admired the most about it was the fact that he reached a point in his life where he realized that through the study of mythology and through the study of the I Ching and several other things that he was getting into, he wanted to take a step back from that, and he went back to very rudimentary things, almost what you would see like a toddler playing with, like toys, and really just observing and examining his own behavior with very rudimentary things to try and really just get back to the foundation of who he is and trying to work backwards into that. And I think that's very telling, that's very profound of what you said. It's psychology begins with self-discovery. It's a self-examination and observing. It really does have to come from you, because what I do in my lectures a lot is I try to show that I turn the camera, my computer, around, and I face it towards the crowd, and I will have everybody just on the projector screen watching themselves, and I'll say, "This, you know, wave at yourself." I'll have everyone wave at themselves, and I'll say, "That person that's waving right back at you is the only one who has been there your entire life. He's the only one, he or she is the only one that truly knows you. This is the person. Why is this not the person that you are running to for every piece of advice, or at least running to first? And why is this not the, you know, the number one person in our lives? Why is this not the person that we trust? Because this person knows all of our fears, knows all of our doubts, knows all of our loves, all of our quirks, all of the things that we may not want to even express to other people, even the closest people in our lives. So I think that's a very profound statement about psychology, is it really is, it starts with you, your own personal observations on yourself.
Yeah, it was very interesting when I began as a university professor, and none of the other psychology courses ever offered anything to people on self-study, whereas that was the basis of the Gurdjieff fourth way teaching. It has to begin with self-study, because you can never study consciousness in another person, because you can never see consciousness. The only way to understand consciousness is within yourself through the experience of your own consciousness. You can never see it outside of yourself. So really the only way, whereas none of the modern intellectual scientists, see, they all confuse consciousness with thinking and the functions of the mind. This
right.
is described by mystics all the time, that it's called the monkeys of the mind. And they explore consciousness using the mind and then think that the mind is what consciousness consists in. And what they need to do is get back to kind of basic self-study and experiencing yourself present in the moment directly. And that's the only way to study consciousness, is within yourself. And that's, I like how you described kind of going through, like reading all these things, but you kind of didn't find yourself till you stopped all the reading and kind of just got back to yourself and your own experience and cultivate awareness in that.
Absolutely. I mean, looking at, especially today, like as what you said, you know, modern scientists typically use the reductionist form of analyzation. They'll try and break things down. Like say if you're looking at a computer and they want to know how it works, you know, they'll break it down into each and every little piece, and then they'll try and say, okay, well, this is what controls that, this is what controls that, and that's what makes the computer go. And they believe that that's the same thing you can do with the human body. And it's the same thing that you can do with just a simple process of what is thought, what is consciousness, what is awareness. And, you know, in the reductionist, you know, modern scientific fashion, I mean, it's this belief that you could just break it down into little chunks and then put it into little categories, label them, and say, okay, this has to do with this, this has to do with that. And when you put these together, it creates that. And it makes it very mechanical, very dry, and very lifeless. And, you know, no wonder that it's, I mean, we're breaking things down smaller and smaller, and we're exploring the tiniest molecules of space, and we're trying to look out larger and more, you know, vaster into the universe, when really that's just what it really is doing in modern science, is it's missing the point of a lot of things. And I think Manly Palmer Hall said in one of his lectures that it's very simple when you look at the universe, when you understand principle. Like, you don't have to examine every little rock, every star, every, you know, flame, every, you know, piece, you know, every portion of dark matter. You don't have to explore every little bit and piece when you understand how principle works, when you understand the essence of things. And that's what I really liked about the lecture I spoke with you about through email that you did on Blavatsky, and how that really is. It's just, it's so much more simple when you really truly understand something as simple. Not saying that consciousness and awareness is simple in that sense, but when modern science tries to break everything down, it's almost like they're looking in the wrong spot for something that is everywhere. Like, they don't seem to have the proper organs, the proper eyes, the proper ears, the proper, you know, nerves, sensations to be able to pick this up, because they're using the wrong tools.
Yeah, and the tool they're using is their mind, I would say. You see, that's right. What it is. It's these intellectual scientists who are all centered in their heads. Yeah. Like, Gurdjieff talks about how there are three types of human beings. Those who are most centered physically, in sensation and movement and physical activity, those centered emotionally, and those centered intellectually. And the people who become academics and scientists are all these very intellectually centered people, and they use their minds to explore consciousness. And that's how they're using the wrong tool, in a way. You know, it's like, you're not going to understand consciousness by reading all the books on consciousness. In fact, if you read all the books on consciousness, you're even further from any understanding than you could ever be, because they're all completely inconsistent and wrong ideas, in a way. It's all this fraud intellectual science, I would call it.
Right. And I guess the best way I could really put it is just think of, If you were trying to examine the scent of a rose, or the scent of something very beautiful, through binoculars or through a microscope or just through the naked eye, if you're trying to examine a very beautiful, you know, olfactory scent through the eye, it's using the wrong tool. And that's why, I mean, you know, at least in my personal opinion, The modern scientific view, this very reductionist, very materialistic view of trying to understand something that really is not material, it's like trying to use your eyes to examine a very beautiful smell or a sound, in a sense. It's just using the wrong tool, and it doesn't matter how intellectual you can be, the most brilliant intellectual mind out there, but you're not going to understand anything beyond the grasp or of that organ. And if that organ is not there to perceive anything else, I mean, Rudolf Steiner got into this immensely about how you have inner faculties that are the organs to use for higher understanding, for higher consciousness. And these are things that, when he speaks about color and when he speaks about spiritual color and sound and things along these lines, it's something that he says it's very difficult to be able to even relay that to somebody who's reading his material in an intellectual fashion, because it's right there using the intellect. You're not going to get it, because you're already using the wrong organ, you're using the wrong tool to understand these things.
Yeah. It's like also like how different mystics say that the stream of thought and minding activity that go on in people is the primary obstacle to the experience of awakening of consciousness. So what these scientists are using to examine consciousness, mystics regard that as an obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that brings to mind is that I learned very early on from Gurdjieff, which was valuable. At the time, I was studying psychology, consciousness in the Western tradition, very influenced by William James, very famous American psychologist,
okay,
philosopher. And William James once said, by states of consciousness are meant such things as thoughts, feelings, intuitions, volitions, and the like. And he even equated the stream of thought with the stream of consciousness. Now, and this he's commonly quoted in the last 50 years of consciousness. Everyone quotes William James. And especially, we see he equates consciousness with thinking, feeling, sensation, volition, and the like. All of those put together give you consciousness. And then I studied Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff says, no, no, that's completely wrong. He says, a human being has different psychological functions, so you can function mentally, emotionally, and physically. Okay, you have your mind in your head, your emotions and feelings connected to your heart, and then you have your physical sensations and physical awareness. But he says consciousness is something different than the psychological functions. So consciousness is not thinking. Consciousness is not feeling. It's not sensation. And he compares it most to light. And just like as you in a room, I have a room here and there's light in the room, so I can be conscious of the bookcase and the table and a bag on the floor and a carpet and the walls. I can be conscious of all of these different things. So similarly, in your inner world, you have this light of consciousness, and it can illuminate the mind, or you can illuminate your emotions, or it can be experienced in the body. But the consciousness is something different than thinking, feeling, and sensation. And so people who approach consciousness by using their mind and thinking about it can never arrive at it, because it's something beyond the method that they're using.
Right, and I
which
think...
Which has to come back to self-study.
Right, and I think a lot of these words are typically like overused by people who pretty much don't examine. Like what I get into a lot is at least examining and truly trying to define the terms that you are going to use. If you're going to use terms, at least understand that you've at least defined those terms, and that's why I get into words like freedom. Like what is freedom truly? But I think things such as consciousness and spirituality, too, are used far too much with very little understanding, and they're lumped into one big category of, you know, consciousness is anything that has to do with what comes out of your brain, with your thoughts, you know. That's a lot of people lump all of that into consciousness. And same with spirituality. People seem to lump anything that cannot be explained scientifically as of this point is in the spiritual realm. And a lot of people, they don't really try even to define a lot of these words. And it really does, it gets into, as you were mentioning before, with what the bleep do we know, and also the book, I guess, The Secret or something like that, The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, I guess it was. They use this method of saying that, okay, this is, you know, this is spiritual in nature, and this is what consciousness truly is, but they don't do very much at all in actually explaining what the essence is of that. They lump it all in one big category, and one of the big problems that I had with The Secret, which was one of the first books that I had read that at least made it to the mainstream, you know, in that sense, that really at least tried to deal with subjects such as consciousness. One of the big problems that I had with that was they had this idea of sitting in front of a vision board and manifesting, you know, the world of your dreams. If you want a car, if you don't feel like you have enough money, if you don't have the girl, if you don't have the dream job or live in that amazing home, then just put it up on a vision board, sit there and meditate it, you know, like the more hours, the better. If you do it day in and day out, eventually it's just going to pop up and, you know, show up in your life. And I think that's, you know, that's pretty, I guess, like the best way that I could put this whole, you know, movement of using terms such as consciousness and spirituality and lumping them in with a bunch of other definitions and terms and ideas that really have nothing to do with it. And that's part of, I guess, what you would say, this false consciousness, this idea of lumping, you know, anything that cannot be explained by science into this spiritual realm and then calling that spirituality. And then so anybody who at least, you know, picks up a book on, you know, an Eastern philosophy or something like that and reads it and says, okay, well, I somewhat understand this, and they intellectually understand it, and they say, well, I guess I have, you know, spiritual understanding now. And, you know, rightfully so, because there's really hardly any tools out there, and there's also so much crap out there that would lead you to believe that this is what consciousness is, this is what spirituality is. And that's really, I guess, why it boils all the way back down to the only, I guess, really the only one that you can trust is yourself in this matter. And what you really should be doing, instead of reading a book and thinking that you know what spirituality is, or reading a book on consciousness and thinking that you understand it, really just take a step back and say, okay, what is learned? What are all these things that I have in my head that are learned, and what do I have within me that is more from experience? And you will realize, very much so with what you had said before, that all the things that you feel within you, all the things that you just you know because it comes through wisdom and experience, these are things that don't come from your head. And you'll be able to recognize it right away. It does not come from the intellect. It won't come from a head-centered, you know, like a spot in your head where you're saying, okay, yes, I get that, you know, intellectually.
No, exactly. Yeah, you don't arrive at those deep understandings through intellectual, rational kind of analysis. No.
The motto for the day is really just self observation and self-discovery, in the sense that that's truly where psychology, you know, begins, and that's truly where everything begins, is this self-awareness, at least being able to take a step back, try, you know, not even, I wouldn't even go so far as to say shutting off the mind, but just feel the differences between head learning and actual soul wisdom. You know, and try and separate the idea of, as you said, the personality with the essence.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like 30 years ago, when I began to study the Gurdjieff teaching, his principal first method is what he calls self-observation, which is exactly what you're getting at. Not analyzing yourself. He says, don't do self-analysis. This is not self-analysis. He says you have to have, like, bare attention and observe yourself, be aware of what the thoughts are, what the feelings are, and what the sensations are. And he says, through our self-observation, we begin to realize the difference between the mind in the head, the emotional aspect, and the physical, and that we want to cultivate our presence so that we're fully conscious physically, emotionally, and mentally simultaneously, which he says then can help you awaken to the next level of attaining to yourself. And that's like a man number four who's developed physically, emotionally, and mentally and brought those into balances, and then the three transform into the fourth. Just like in the musical octave, you go do, re, mi. Most people in their consciousness octaves only go do, re, mi, do, re, mi. They don't get further. They don't get to the fa. That's where you have a missing semitone. Fa, sol, la, which are higher levels of human beings. Like Gurdjieff says, there are seven levels of human existence. Masses of people are only physical, emotional, and mental types. Very few people attain to the experience of their true self, their essential consciousness. And that's like a next level that we, that's how he would see human evolution.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, hopefully, I mean, what can at least come from the film and interviews like this, and, you know, hopefully, you know, people are starting to at least come to the understanding that the way things have been done, you know, up to this point, in a large part are lacking in a lot of way of self-discovery, self-understanding, and what I get into being just self-governance and self-owning, at least being able to own your own responsibility. And in a sense, that's why I always get back to it. There's this one quote by Arno Gruen in which he says, when people base their identity on identifying with authority, then freedom causes anxiety. And the reason why I bring that up is because a lot of what we see today, you know, in the family-based structure, in, you know, just in our local communities, in, you know, in countries at large and the world at large, is really everything seems to be this hierarchy of authority figures. Everybody has the next level up that they have to answer to. And, you know, there's the parental figure in the family, and then when you move on from that, then you replace that with authority figures out in your local community, like police, judges, all the way up to your boss, governmental figures, your religion if you're attached to one. And pretty much what that does in that statement, if we base our identity on identifying with authority, then freedom causes anxiety. And that's really the staple of what I try to get at in a lot of my work is, if you don't understand what freedom is, then you can say it all you want. You know, like I was saying, under the Bush administration, this whole motto of like, you know, this is the land of the free. We are free. You know, regardless of what happened on 9/11, we are free. We're still a free country. You know, throwing that word free around, and people just seem to get caught up in it like a mantra, and not really understanding what freedom truly is. And what is really happening is people are anxious. They feel a great deal of anxiety and fear from true freedom, because true freedom, as of this point, means, you know, giving up all of these authority figures that make us feel a little bit more safe in our comfort zone.
Yeah, they give you security. Yeah, right. They give you security. There was a very interesting book. Have you ever heard of Eric Fromm? He was in the psychoanalytic schools, and he had a book called Escape from Freedom. And partly he was Jewish and was in Germany during the World War II, and he was trying to afterwards understand like the psychology of Nazism and how people could so come fall under like a tyrannical leader like Adolf Hitler. So his whole understanding was how people can't tolerate that freedom, and then they want to surrender that to authorities, exactly as you're describing. So, and they're afraid of the freedom, and they don't really know what it means. And see, from my perspective, I would say the masses of people have no freedom. They're completely enslaved. They're complete automatons conditioned by their upbringing, their parents, their society, that they have no inner freedom. But, and you can only attain to freedom when you awaken within the self, and then you can attain your higher will. Like, I believe there's a higher will, and if we can awaken, then you attain freedom. Otherwise, you're a slave. Like, the masses of people are slaves and robots. They've been conditioned. They're brainwashed. And they have no freedom. They can't make a free choice. They don't know themselves. They can't control their own thoughts or emotions. They are ridden with anxieties, depression, addictions, and so on. Like, people are completely enslaved. And the mystical path is one of attaining to freedom by overcoming these patterns of conditioning that have been imposed on us.
Absolutely. And I'm actually very glad to hear you mention Eric Fromm. That reminds me, he wrote another book called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. And there was a quote in there that actually said, "We ourselves reproduce catastrophe because we ourselves are traumatized." And I believe that that's a very profound statement about how we truly do create our world around us. And the reason why people may find that hard to believe is because they don't understand how, well, I wouldn't have wanted this car accident, or I wouldn't have wanted this to happen. I didn't want this political leader. You know, I didn't choose for this to happen. And they're still not making that discernment between what is the intellect and also, you know, just what is conscious and unconscious, you know, the subconscious, and also what is intellect and what is awareness, what is consciousness. And it's obviously it's going to be very difficult to understand how we reproduce our catastrophe if we are so traumatized to begin with that all of these emotions, all these things that we've gone through that we wouldn't even maybe understand to be a form of trauma, we don't ever bring them up and truly process them. Even if we, I mean, what some people don't realize is that repression doesn't have to be something that you don't remember. It's something that you don't process. And in repressing something, you can remember a certain situation of trauma. It doesn't matter what it is. But if you're not processing it, if you're not, let's say, grieving in the right way, or if you're not at least working through it on a level to at least surpass that, whatever that trauma is, then you keep reproducing that catastrophe to bring it to the forefront of consciousness, because you're in some level, in some way, you're trying to process it over and over and over again. But what it is this: it's this identity, it's this personality that doesn't want that to be attached to the personality, so it keeps pushing it away. So no wonder we keep getting caught in these loops and these cycles over and over and over again, and not understanding why the world is the way it is. No wonder it's so insane.
Yeah, really. A couple of associations. It reminds me of Freud talked about repetition compulsion and how the person's been traumatized. They keep repeating the same pattern as a way of trying to unconsciously deal with their original traumatization. So they, and that's what you're saying we're doing. We're creating this ourselves. Another thing it reminds, talking about traumatization and such and repression. As a psychologist, the most important thing I've learned through my mystical studies is that how do people deal with trauma? They have to recall them and speak about it, and as they do it, they have to restore their natural breath. Because what happens is someone is traumatized, they contract and they hold their breath. So if you go through life being traumatized, after a while, people don't breathe anymore. And in mystical teachings, your soul life is connected to your breath. In Genesis, God breathes into man a living soul. So what happens is people get traumatized, they're breathing, they develop muscular armoring, and their breathing becomes more and more contracted. And they can't breathe anymore. And as a psychologist, I could always tell this, how people would hold their breath. They chronically hold their breath. Like in the States, 40% of people are on Prozac for antidepressant medication. Okay, main thing with people who are depressed, they don't breathe anymore. They sit holding chronically their breath. And what you have to learn to do is exhale. And then breathe into your abdomen and reestablish your natural breathing. And that's what people need to do to get over trauma. You have to kind of bring it back to mind and talk about it and breathe through it and reestablish your natural breathing. And then that'll rid you of that pattern, fixated pattern of emotional blockages. So, I mean, people are traumatized. The whole United States was traumatized by 9/11. It was traumatic. That's why people still can't face the truth of it, because it was so traumatizing, they've never dealt with the original trauma of it. And then even more traumatizing to find out the truth. You know, that's even worse.
Right. And that's, you know, that's also another, you know, very profound way to put it, because people, in a sense, they find comfort in something. Even, you know, if it's a trauma such as 9/11, they'll find some way to at least make it comfortable for them, whether they can deal with it correctly or not. They'll make it comfortable, and then if something else even comes along to counteract what they became comfortable with, they reject it. That's why what you'll see a lot of the times is there'll be cancer patients that are told that they're terminal and they only have a few months to live, and whether the diagnosis was wrong or something changed, they'll get maybe 2 weeks down the line, or maybe even a month down the line, the doctor will come back and say, listen, sorry, there was a mistake, you're actually going to live. And what's actually been found is that these patients that get the news that they're actually going to live, they go through another form of trauma in a way, because they have already at least accepted or dealt with their life in a manner within the past month that they were certain that they were going to die, to where they became comfortable with that scenario. Whether they truly accepted it deep down inside or not, they became comfortable in a certain way. It's actually a traumatic experience to learn that they're going to live again. So that's very telling with what you just said. Even with the whole 9/11 thing, people don't want to know the truth about certain things. They want to believe what they feel comfortable with. And that's when people truly do start examining not what they are attracted to, not what the kinds of information that they're attracted to or the kinds of information that they reject, but why. What is it about certain things that they feel compelled to or repelled from? And that's when you start to understand that a lot of people are centered in this pleasure principle or this comfort factor, to where all they're looking for is, the only reason why they'll get up, move around, or do anything or make any effort in any way is to move closer to pleasure or comfort. And it's very uncomfortable. And, like you said, that the process of death, that catabolic phase where you're breaking things down, it could be very, very uncomfortable. And as you were saying, with bringing up forms of trauma and working through them, talking through them, and breathing through them, a lot of the times that could be very uncomfortable for people. And some people would rather peel the Band-Aid off very slowly throughout their entire lives than just get it over with, go through the pain, go through that ordeal, and then release it, let it go.
Yeah, I see that in psychotherapy, because I can see how people withdraw from exploring the trauma, like they contract from it and have all kinds of defenses to prevent going into it, and yet that is what they need is to go into it and bring it out. Psychotherapy often is trying to undermine the defenses to help bring them back into it, that they can bring it up into consciousness again and talk about it and then bring it into the light. Because a lot of things, people are traumatized by things early in their life which they've always been afraid to think about again. So they won't put their attention into it and make the effort to bring it up and talk about it and then breathe through it. Like, psychologists generally don't know that breathing is important. Your soul life is connected to your breath life. And the more people contract and hold in their breath, they keep all these trauma within them. And then also people who become conditioned in the false consciousness system, what happens is their essence remains underdeveloped. Like, you can have a 50-year-old man who in his essence, and he may be an intellectual and have read all these books and theories and can pontificate forever, but in his essence, he may have the essence of a 5 or 6 year old child, that emotionally he's like a small, spoiled child that he never developed in his essence. That's what happens with these elites a bit, that they may be very brilliant intellectually and with their sciences and manipulation and so on, but in their emotional center, they're like spoiled little children who want their way and power over other people. Like, there's something so underdeveloped in them. So people do fear bringing these things up because they do feel empty inside. It's very interesting in your movie, the one fellow at the end, he had some very interesting sections on about people. I forget the younger fellow with the who spoke well. Who's that in your film?
Was it at the very end? Because there was a Swedish fellow named Henrik Palmgren that had a short section. And then
it wasn't him. It was the American fellow, and he spoke about people. Oh, that was you.
Oh yeah.
Oh, it was. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, you spoke very well about the voidness in people and the emptiness in them.
Right.
You had really insightful comments about that. Because one of the things I've learned from mystical teachings, according to mystics, in the heart, there's what the Kabbalists call the zimzum contraction, which creates an emptiness in the heart. So everybody naturally has this emptiness in the heart. But most people in life are afraid of the emptiness. They want to be something. They don't want to be no thing.
Right.
And to be the emptiness. Whereas the mystic path, in a way, is to strip away all the thingness to get back to your no thingness. And then to live in that no thingness.
Right. There was actually, Alan Watts spoke of something very similar, being the somethingness and the nothingness, and how nothingness is, it's always there. It's ever pervasive. It's always there. And that is something that, at least intellectually, people are afraid of. They, like you said, it's, that was a very good way to put it. Everybody wants to be something. No one wants to be nothing. Because that right there, that's the death. You know, that is the ego collapse. That's the loss of identity. And when you're under the assumption that all we are is this personality, all we are is this identity, then that feels like we are going to become nothingness. And we'll leave without a trace. And there will be, no one else will even remember us after we die. I mean, look at the movie Troy. At least the most recent one where Brad Pitt, the whole point of what he was talking about in the beginning was to become immortal, if not only by just legend. You know, it's this idea of wanting to be remembered, wanting to be that something forever, and never wanting to be that nothing. And it really does. And Alan Watts says that it's something that we already are. He gets a lot into, you know, there cannot be the black without the white. You know, they are both very inherent in existence. And so this somethingness and nothingness, they're both always there. And the nothingness, it's very interesting thing to look into, at least to try and understand it. And again, it's that something that you can't really, you can explore intellectually, but there's a whole another dimension to it that, you know, when you actually explore it on, you know, a deeper level, you will come to understand that nothingness is something. Well, it's kind of hard to say it like that. No,
but that's exactly right. Yeah.
And so, it's definitely, and Alan Watts, I mean, obviously explains it a lot better than I could, but that is another great teacher that, you know, I've learned quite a bit from.
Yeah, I listen to Alan's on RBN quite often. He doesn't, in my view, understand the esoteric side of occult teachings that he criticizes. That's the only problem. But in terms of his knowledge of the kind of intellectual philosophizing of the pseudo-elites and their whole kind of self-serving pathological philosophy, he understands that really well. But just to stick with this theme, you're familiar with Jean-Paul Sartre, likely. Yeah. You seem quite studied. And his main book was Being and Nothingness. And his main idea about consciousness is that consciousness is like a nothingness. Because whenever you're conscious, he says, you're always conscious of something, like a thought or a feeling or a sensation. You're always conscious of something. But consciousness in itself is like this no-thingness. And he calls it the nothingness at the heart of being. And in mystical teachings, although Sartre was an existentialist and atheist, in mystical teachings, mystics say that's exactly the truth, that there is a form of nothingness at the heart of being within ourselves, and that there's an actual higher dimensional physics to that nothingness, because it has to do with the nature of the quantum vacuum and the ether and our zero-point field.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea in mysticism, one other association I have is a Sufi says, not since God brought man out of nothingness have we ceased to be travelers. So the idea is that there's something in that nothingness. Those of us who are, in a way, willing to be no thing, in a way, that no thingness becomes an abundance, and it's like the pleroma. It's like you can then be all things. It's like, if you become the no thing, then you can somehow be all things.
Right.
Your film started beautifully with a beautiful sections of the very first part of your movie talking about the self and its connection to the universe. I was very inspired at the beginning also.
The intro itself?
Intro? What you said about the self. I just see my notes here. Self is the universe, the alpha and the omega.
Mm-hmm.
Totally, I would agree with that. See, I think a person has a zero-point center in the heart. And when you're born, life begins from a point within the heart, and that's the alpha, and it expands without, and then eventually it contracts without, within, and back into the omega point. So we are the self is the alpha, and the first point and the last point. And
right.
It persists the whole time through, kind of.
Absolutely.
But that your movie begins very nicely with that. This is, I didn't know if you were also involved in the movie The Esoteric Agenda.
Yes, that was something that I mean, a few years ago I was involved with. I did quite a bit of research for that. I wasn't the only one who came up with that. And the reason why I don't have that involved with Talismanic Idols now, and the reason why I don't have that on the Talismanic Idols site, it has its own site, because I still think there's a lot of kernels of truth in there. There's a lot of good, tidbits of information, but I sort of, especially within the past year or so, wanted to remove myself from the way that it was presented, but I still think that it's information and it should be out there. I'm leaving it out there, obviously, but I'm just, in a sense, like, my research is moving on from that, and I started doing, my own personal research and just my own films and working with my brother, so that's why I wanted to start fresh with Kymatica and move on from this point.
Well, it's a very valuable film and really gets you thinking more, and it's valuable. I hope people will watch it. You can order it. Do you want to give out your website or how people can order the movie or see your work further?
Everything I have, I'll just say this right now. Everything that I do film-wise will always be for free online. I believe that not only is that the best way to just get it out there and spread the word about the information. But I believe that there are a lot of people that, whether they can't or whether there's just some reason why they don't want to put the money down or whether they just don't have a credit card or anything along those lines, I like to have it for free online. So both Kymatica and Esoteric Agenda are on Google Video. So, and a lot of people will upload it themselves. There's a lot with subtitles, different languages that you can see. So it's all online. But if you'd like to support, because I'm making films constantly and I'm traveling constantly, if you'd like to buy a high-quality DVD, talismanicidols.org is where you can buy Kymatica and everything that I do from this point on. But there is also a website for Esoteric Agenda, which is esotericagenda.net. and you can purchase the films there. And I try and give bulk prices because a lot of people do ask, you know, can I buy 20 and pass them out to friends? And that's absolutely fine. I try and give, like, the best price I possibly can. And I also encourage people, if you want to buy just one copy and make as many copies as you want, burn them onto DVD-Rs and just hand them out to friends, I encourage any of that. So really, this is just about trying to get the information out there and spreading the word. But again, talismanicidols.org and esotericagenda.net are the two websites you can go to for these films.
You know, that's really nice that, you know, you make your work available to people like that. And you know, these, like Alex Jones does, you know, and he says, copy it and distribute my work. And there's a whole genre of you truth activists, like truth seekers, coming out with this new genre of truth movies and documentaries. This is so valuable. It's a way of pulling things together for people. And, you know, you don't know all the answers, you know, but you're not pretending to. It really gets you to go take steps deeper to try to understand our situation more deeply. And, you know, I hope people do order and buy your work. It's such a shame, you know, I hardly ever get Hollywood movies anymore because every time I watch them, it's like, oh, what a waste of time. Like, there's so senseless violence and titillation and stupidity,
right.
Really. And they're so senseless. And then there you are and other filmmakers like yourself, you know, kind of in this urgent time on this planet doing such important work to try to make people think and look at our situation. And where do you get support? You know, it's like no one cares. So it's such a shame. It's like just more of that injustice, you know. But so
right.
I do hope people, I mean, you know, good for you that you're continuing with your work and being part of such an important venture.
Well, absolutely. And
yeah,
I think, you know, with opportunities like this and having, you know, pretty much your program here is a great opportunity. You know, without you, I wouldn't be doing anything on this Saturday. I wouldn't be spreading the word at all. You know, so it is really a community, and I have the utmost faith in what's to come. Personally, you know, that's just my own personal humble opinion, but I have the utmost faith in people in general, and I really do believe that people are getting to a point where they're starting to ask the serious questions, and they're starting to at least, if it's just a notion or just a feeling, they're starting to feel like that things that they always thought worked a certain way or always thought that, you know, this was reality, they're coming to an understanding that maybe it's time to start looking a little bit deeper. And when they do, they find, you know, the Benjamin Stewarts, they find the Alex Jones, you know, they find the Christopher Holmes, they find these people, and that's when they, I get so many emails from people that just say, you know what, I don't understand your film 100%, or I don't agree with it 100%, or I agree with all of it, and I understand it completely. Regardless of what they say, I get so many emails of people just saying, you know what, thank you for your contribution, and you have inspired
yeah.
me to do my own work in this field. And you know what, that is the most beautiful gift. I would rather get 1,000 or 1,000,000 emails like that than get 1,000 or $1,000,000, you know, in my pocket. I would so much rather find that, you know, a large group of people are finally starting to ask the serious questions and starting to do their own homework and really starting to discover who they are on the inside, because that's really the reason why I'm doing this. That's the reason why I have it for free up online. And, you know, I presume that's, you know, that's why you're doing such a service to humanity. That's why Alex Jones and all these other people in this field are doing this service for other people, because we truly do have, I really do have the utmost faith in the direction that we're heading.
Yeah, I wish I had such faith, because I see this as bordering on pretty monstrous things, but I don't know. I mean, I see by 2012, I think there's going to be a new beginning, because I think between now and then we're going to actually change the world situation. But that's just, you know, that you work like yours and mine, you know, we're trying to help towards that movement to wake people up. Look, let's look at what's happening in the world. I mean, you just look at all this violence and wars through human history. It's so tragic. And it's always innocent people who are murdered, and all the wars are based on lies. It's like we never grew up, you know, we're like spoiled little children with guns, and, you know, it's so tragic. You know, it's like the human race never had a chance to really be ourselves and to grow, to evolve. And so, you know, these, what we're doing, this is, you know, I believe we're in end times. Hopefully it'll turn that it'll be the beginning of a new cycle and not a kind of fascist new world order, you know, but we're at that critical point and, you know, your work's important and thank you for what you've done. And we only got a minute. I have to let you go. Are you working at a new movie venture?
Yes. There's a new film and a whole new project coming out. It's called The Hanged Man Project. And, it's still in its infancy, so I really can't get too much into that, but I would
just say to the listeners
to keep checking back.
Is that based on the Tarot, The Hanged Man?
Yes, it's based
on the
idea, right. Yes, it's definitely based
on
that idea.
I always wondered if Christ was really hung upside down, because all the early Christians were hung upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep,
anyway, I'm going to take a minute to wrap up myself. I've only got 2 minutes left here. So thank you, Benjamin. And I invite you back when you want to come back sometime and talk about your next venture, even to share some of it ahead of time.
Absolutely. Thank you for this great opportunity.
Okay. Take care. Goodbye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. So I just have a couple minutes left here. I'd like to thank BBS Radio, Don and Doug, keep the network going. I would like to thank Don Nikoloff for having me on his show this last week, and I listen to him regularly, Evident Footprints, 1 a.m. Eastern. My website's zeropoint.ca. I have some excellent books, The Heart Doctrine and The Secret Doctrine book, are very profound books. I hardly ever get any orders for them. Please visit my website at zeropoint.ca. I appreciate any contribution to help me continue in my work. Okay, remember yourself. As you go about your life, keep breathing. Okay, we got to breathe and be prayerful and be awakened in the heart and try to have courage to face these times of madness. Let's take our world back. Thank you.